thank you for coming in. Very impressed with my size audience. And so this is my second year at being at this home show. I appreciate the opportunity. And we're talking about today the subject of exporting, and particularly these three areas: operations, procedures, and compliance. But at any point in time, if you have a question, or you have a comment, or you want to challenge anything I say, please feel free to do that. So one thing about export is that exports out of the United States is growing dramatically. Okay? The imbalance still exists between imports and exports, but that gap is lessening. And there are a number of reasons for that. One of them is what we call the COVID benefit, is that while all transportation infrastructures and supply chain infrastructures in the world suffered through COVID, the U.S. didn't suffer as much as everybody else did. And therefore, a lot of companies in certain countries around the world have not been able to sell their goods in foreign markets, so a lot of those foreign markets look to the United States to fulfill those orders. So there are a lot of companies that lost their export market through the 2010-2015 period, all the way to 2020, that gained back that market share now, okay, because of that COVID impact. And there's still a residual impact of the COVID issue that's impacting supply chains, but not as greatly here in the United States. For anybody involved in supply chains, everybody realizes that the recovery has already passed us now, and we're already moving forward. Most of the residual factors here in this country are dissipated almost completely now, which is obviously good news. But the other factor is the quality of product that's manufactured in the United States. The world depends upon it, that if they turn something on, it's going to work, and they turn it on consistently, it's going to work consistently. Our customer service is second to none, the ability to pick up the phone and talk to somebody and get a problem resolved as compared to some places around the world. The options of products in terms of the choices of colors and sizes and customization is much broader here than in other markets around the world. Our transportation reliability is really second to none in the whole world. Europe is probably a pretty good second, but the United States, North America, including Mexico and Canada, are significant options. And the last one is payment terms. So the United States' financial posture is so strong that it's able to offer really good financing terms on export activity, and that puts them into a very competitive position. So we have these three pillars of exporting that we need to be paying attention to, which is the operations, the procedures, and the compliance element of international business that we have to pay attention to. So do you guys have heard the term demurrage? You ever heard that term, demurrage? Okay. How about you, sir? Demurrage? Okay. So demurrage is additional costs and freight that go above and beyond what was expected that the carrier is going to charge somebody who's involved in importing or exporting. And how that happens is that carriers are hubs that move freight through the system very quickly. So when an airline lands at Chicago Airport from Germany, Lufthansa Airlines as an example, they've got to move that cargo out of their facility very quickly because they're not geared up for handling 10 planes, 20 planes in a row and holding that freight in their facility. So they give the importer in Chicago 3 days to come in and pull that freight out. And if I was exporting something to Rotterdam, okay, I have the same circumstances. The steamship line, let's just say CMA lines, doesn't have a facility that can hold freight for a long period of time, so it has to move it. So it says to its customers that you've got 3 days once it arrives to pick it up. So appreciate the fact that if somebody doesn't pick it up, the carrier penalizes that company, and it's called demurrage. And the first day they charge $25, and the next day it's $50, the next day it's $100, goes up incrementally. And sometimes after a week or so, the demurrage costs more than the freight itself. Okay? So what happens, in this particular case, a New Jersey home furnishings company sends 4 container loads of home furnishings going to a number of retailers that were located in Germany, France, Netherlands, and Spain. And the importer was their first time they were importing from the United States. The exporter was a pretty experienced exporter, but had not traded with this particular company before, and they created a sale, and the goods got to the port of Hamburg, and it got stuck. So the first problem, because we're going to cover about export documentation that came into play in this particular case, is that the shipper, which was based down in Raleigh-Durham, which is where the goods were actually manufactured through this selling agent in New Jersey, they created documents that they use every day for qualifying the nature of the wood that was used, what processes was used in the manufacturing process. But that documentation did not meet EU requirements. So customs in Hamburg rejected the shipment from coming in. So appreciate the fact that that rejection now leaves the cargo on the pier, and if more than 3 days goes, demurrage kicks in, okay? And in this particular case, demurrage started out at $150 US a day, then goes to 300, right, then goes to 600. So it doesn't take too long before you're over $1,000. The freight on this particular transaction was $1,400. So in 6 days, they hit that mark. So now the question is, in this transaction, who's responsible to pay that demurrage? Is it the seller of the goods, or is it the buyer of the goods, right? So we got pulled into this because they hired an attorney, and the attorney wasn't able to resolve the particular problem. He knew what legally was involved, but he needed to resolve the problem, so he called our company in. So the issue here in picking this apart is that there wasn't anywhere in the contract of sale or the purchase order anything that addressed this subject of demurrage, okay, which needs to be addressed in all international contracts. And so in this particular case, we ended up getting them the right documents so that they could clear these goods, now almost 3 weeks after the fact. We negotiated a settlement with the steamship line, because that's always negotiable. We were able to reduce the demurrage. But the most important task we had was to train that importer in Europe and the exporter, both in New Jersey and Raleigh, how do we make this not happen again, right? So the idea was that they should have, before that good was shipped, understood what was needed in Europe in order to get those goods clear, which is they needed a QIS certificate showing that the wood went through a particular treatment before it was allowed into Europe, okay? Of which they actually met that qualification, but they just didn't provide any certification that ascertained that it had. Okay, so that became an issue. For the importer didn't know that they needed this coming from the United States. They knew they needed it coming from China, but they didn't know they needed it coming from the United States, so they didn't request it. Okay, so they ended up accepting the fact that they both had liability here because they were trading partners, okay, as compared to creating an adversarial relationship. I'm talking about relationship a little bit later on. Second case study is a California specialty cookware company that about 5 years ago started to expand selling their product in a lot of different places in the world. They were traditionally selling in Europe and Latin America, and they decided when they hired this new sales executive that he was going to open up other places in the world. So one of the places that he opened up, because there's a tremendous amount of business development going on and a lot of growth of consumerism, is in countries like Nigeria in Africa, certain parts of Northern Africa, okay, Egypt as an example, and also in the Middle East, countries like UAE, Kuwait, and so forth, Dubai, are all flourishing and building a huge middle-class economy. So this cookware company started to sell the product, and The nature of the sale was almost like on an e-commerce basis. They were smaller shipments sold through their website, and they used DHL to handle the transactions. So one of the things that anybody who imports or anybody who exports in the United States, they have to check what's referred to as the denied parties list. Denied parties list is a list that 8 government agencies, such as U.S. Customs, the FBI, Department of Justice, State Department, a couple of examples, create that says these are guys that we've identified as bad boys for whatever reason, and you cannot do business with them as an importer or an exporter. And it's a requirement that anybody exporting something or importing something check that list before they engage in that transaction. And about 15 years ago, the government also changed the rules that put exposure on the carriers themselves, the companies that handle the shipping, that they can't deal with these parties either, or help a U.S. importer or exporter facilitate a transaction. So in this particular case, they had a bunch of orders going to about 9 different countries in North Africa, West Africa, and the Middle East. And DHL, unfortunately, instead of calling them and telling them they had a problem, they did what they were legally responsible to do, which is report them. And they reported them that a number of the companies that they were shipping to were actually denied parties. Now, in practice, DHL should have picked up the phone and called them and said, hey, did you check this list? Because we're checking, and you can't sell to these parties because they're a customer, but they chose not to do that. They just reported them to the Department of Commerce. And so it created a whole snowball of problems for this company. So they ended up paying about $60,000 in fines relative to the specific action, and then had another almost $100,000 of penalty. And that penalty was assessed because they had nothing in their export process that held them to be compliant. So there was a transactional fine and then a penalty because they failed to have anything in their process to be a compliant company. Because once you get audited, you're not just asked about that. You're asked about the documentation, your record keeping, your evaluation, all kinds of issues like that. And the government saw in that audit tremendous amount of problems. That's when we got brought in because we're a partner with the Department of Commerce to help them get themselves organized so that they continue to sell, but now do it correctly. They can. The government has a right to go back historically in 5 years' worth of data and transactions. Correct. Okay. The audits could be random where they just pull certain things, no different like when we as individuals go through the border, we could be randomly pulled, or there could be a red flag that has occurred.
Oh, Mike, the question is, there was the transactional fine for the penalty of that transaction, but my question was, the company was also fined another on the process that they didn't have in place. So it was triggered because the government find out about this transactional fee, so they are automatically go into this other penalty.
Correct.
Or it could be a random check by the government, then you go under the systematic fine again too.
Yes to all that, and to say it in kind of different words is that what they do is they send in an assessor, an auditor, okay? And the first question that they ask is, who's in charge of compliance in your organization, right? So that's the first question they ask. So if you don't have anybody in charge of compliance, that's a problem all by itself, because the law requires that you do. Second thing they're gonna ask you for is a set of standard operating procedures, SOPs, to manage your trade compliance responsibilities. If you don't have those SOPs in place, then that's a problem. So appreciate the fact, because we sat in these conversations, is that the company was, you know, naked in this case because they didn't know any better, right? So They got fined at a transaction level, and they got penalized because they didn't have anything in place, and they didn't know any better. 5 years ago, 6 years ago, it used to be that in export regulation that you could turn away and said, I didn't know. I wasn't informed. Nobody told me. But about 5 or 6 years ago, the government changed the rules to say that we're adding on the words should have known versus what they knew, okay, that they should have known what they needed to do. So these are two examples of why we're even having this whole conversation, to make sure that companies keep themselves out of trouble. So appreciate the fact that we make the statement that export documents are import documents. And what we mean is that when we sell goods overseas, we only have one document that's required by the U.S. government on that export transaction, which is what's called the Shipper's Export Declaration. It's a document which is now done electronically, where we advise the Department of Commerce or the Department of State, here's what we're actually shipping. It has about 80 pieces of information in that electronic format that's exchanged. That's the only document that's required. Now, we'll create a commercial invoice and a packing list, bills of lading, quality control documents and things like that, but they're not required. What we're concerned about is, what do they need in Belgium? What do they need in Japan? What do they need in South Africa to import those goods into that country? That's the critical question. So export documents really are created for the purpose of helping your customer overseas facilitate the import process in their country. Okay, so we always say that export documents really, at the end of the day, are import documents. Now, we say the statement, documentation is the engine of global trade. So I ask everybody in the audience here in the United States, what percentage of goods that come through the border from overseas do you think customs actually inspects? You can just guess. What do you think? 20%. 50%. What do you think? 50%. 5%? Okay. It's actually 3%. Okay, so out of every 97 transactions that come into the United States, statistically, only 3 are physically inspected coming in, right? Which is one of the reasons when you hear all this activity of how drugs come into the country or illegal things come in, because people roll the dice, and if you roll it enough, you're going to have a certain amount that comes through. It just happens. So what about the rest of the world? Japan, China, Brazil, Venezuela. Okay, Mexico, what do you think their percentage is? If we're 3%, what do you think they are? Sorry, again? You tell me. You say lower, okay? Just actually a little higher. It's about 4.5%, 5%, right? So it's a little bit higher. Now, there are certain countries around the world that inspect 100% of everything that comes in, and they're the exception. What would be a country like that? What do you think? No, but Australia is actually pretty tough, but no. Nope. We shouldn't be exporting anything to North Korea. So, offices right there. Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Abu Dhabi, UAE, Jordan. Why? Because they have a religion and a government which are tied together. They don't want to have any drugs in their country. They don't want to have any pornography in their country. They don't want to have any clothing that would be considered skimpy for a woman or anything being sold in their economy. So in order for them to control it, and they're all wealthy nations, right, they have the money, they have the border where every package is opened and everything is inspected. If any of you ever travel, I travel 2 or 3 times a year to the Middle East, particularly to Saudi Arabia. It's not a guess of whether I'm going to be pulled and checked. It happens 100% where you're pulled in the line. It takes a good hour and a half to get through customs there because everybody gets pulled into a room, your bags are opened, and you're frisked. Okay. So it just happens. Okay, an export are vigorously controlled. We're talking about here from the United States. I also appreciate there are a lot of other countries around the world where exports are vigorously controlled. Canada would be another example. Japan would be another example. The UK, Germany, number of those countries around the world have very vigorous export controls. And I'll share with you later how that actually happens. But appreciate the fact that you can't just sell anything anywhere around the world. The U.S. puts very tight controls on that process. So in export operations, we have six categories, which we're going to talk about. The contract of sale, the Incoterm, the documentation, the logistics, moving the goods from point A to point B, client and import concerns, and getting paid. Okay, so in the concept of the contract of sale, that's usually generated by a purchase order, meaning that a foreign supplier has given us a PO, and that states the terms. But we're going to turn that around, possibly to an export contract sale, which we can, or a commercial invoice, which is really a contract that says, here's what I'm selling to you, you know, and so forth. And an extension of a commercial invoice is a packing list, okay? So we have to be concerned now with those import documentation requirements, okay? We have the terms of sale, which is the Incoterm. We'll look at that in a little bit more detail. The terms of how we're going to get paid, how insurance is handled, how freight is handled, title, and posting of the sale. So if I'm an exporter and I sell something to a foreign buyer, let's say in Germany, and I make that sale on March 1st, and the sale is supposed to be shipped by the 30th of March, it's going to go ocean freight, so it's going to get there by April 1st, and the payment terms are that they've got 15 days upon arrival to pay me, so while the sale's being made today, I'm not likely to receive those funds until April 15th, right? So now I have a CFO who wants to see that activity in our ledger. So at what point could that company post that export sale? What do you think? You got plenty of dates in there going from March 1st all the way to April 15th. What do you think? Date of arrival, okay. Anybody else? I'm sorry?
I didn't grab the question properly.
You've got these different dates. You get an order in on March 1st. You have to ship by the end of the month. Goes by ocean freight, so it takes 3 or 4 weeks to get there. And then you have payment terms, which says that once the goods arrive there, they have 15 days to pay you. So let's say April 15th, they pay payment to you. At what day can you post that export transaction? That's the question. Does that make sense to you? Okay, and she said, once you arrive, right, in the country. Okay? It's not governed by any of those dates or the factors. The very simple issue is that it's governed by the IRS and the Securities and Exchange Commission and how you can post the sale. And it asks for four things. One is, do you have a purchase order? Yes, we have a purchase order. Can you meet the obligations under that purchase order? Second obligation is met. The third is there a reasonable expectation you're going to get paid? You're not going to sell it or ship unless that's the case. And the last one is that you've tendered it to a carrier whose intent is to move it internationally. So when you hand it to the freight forwarder, you handle it to DHL, it's at that moment you can post the sale. So it's a lot earlier in the supply chain than most companies actually use. When we do audits in companies, we look at that because it can improve their cash flow advantage pretty significantly in being able to post that at an earlier point, as long as those four criteria are met. So one of the things that everybody in international trade, both importers and exporters, need to be paying attention to is the concept of Incoterm, International Commercial Terms. In Paris, there's the International Chamber of Commerce. The International Chamber of Commerce, under a charter from the United Nations, says that any country in the world that participates with the United Nations must use Incoterms in its international business. Okay? So the terms like FOB, CIF, GDP, DAP, things like that, that's what Incoterms are. Okay? But appreciate the fact that here in the United States, there isn't anything in any state, local, or federal law that mentions Incoterms. So Incoterms we utilize, but they're not in a capacity of being a legal entity, okay? But contracts of sale, purchase orders, commercial invoices are recognized internationally. So if an Incoterm resides within a PO or in a commercial invoice or in a packing list, okay, then it has jurisdiction here in the United States. But by himself, you'll never see the fact of Incoterms being raised by a government agency here in the United States. It's not the same around the world. Incoterms are much more the fabric of their trade in every other country around the world, with the exception of the United States. So at the end of the day, what Incoterms is a point in time where the responsibility and liability transfers between a seller and a buyer. I go to the store, I go downtown here in Chicago, and I go to Macy's, and I buy something, okay, and they put it in a bag, I give them a credit card, it clears. That's the point in time that that's transferred to me. It's my responsibility. Anything happens to it, it's my responsibility, okay? So if you have a shipment that's originating in Chicago that's going down to Santiago, Chile, right, some 8,000, 9,000 miles away, at what point in time does that occur? And that's what Incoterm tries to address, is that at what point in time in that supply chain does a transfer take place between that seller and the buyer? So we looked at this particular circumstance of an export, right? And you looked at the fact that there are typically three legs of the journey. There's the movement from Chicago to Baltimore, from the inland gateway origin point to the outbound gateway, which is Baltimore, when it's going to board a ship, okay? When it goes across the ocean, that's the international leg. And then once it arrives at Hamburg, it's got to go to a final destination. So the Incoterms moves the point in time down the line, okay? When Incoterms first came out in 1948, following World War II, there were 28 Incoterms. And Incoterms change and get modified every 10 years, okay, in the history of man. And each time they modify it, they reduce the number. So now we have 11 Incoterms. And the feel is that come 2030, when the Incoterms change, they'll move to 7. They keep trying to simplify it and make it easy for companies and people to deal with. I just show an import transaction where if I was buying something in China or in Shenzhen, this is an air freight shipment, okay? If I purchased it ex works, that means I'm taking responsibility at the customer's or the supplier's facility in Shenzhen. If I purchased it FCA Hong Kong Free Carrier Act, it's once it arrives to the airline, that's when that point in time is. I got it CIP, carriage and insurance paid too, arrives at JFK. It's at that point in time after it arrives, that's when I, as the importer, now have to take responsibility. And if I got it DDP, delivered duty paid, they have to deliver it all the way to my Edison location, pay duties and taxes, okay? And that's the most complete one. So appreciate the fact that what's being addressed here is cost and risk. At what point in time is cost at risk. So as an exporter, we have to know what that is because we have to make sure that our interests are being protected in that transaction if something was to happen. Okay, so as part of the handout here, and let me just ask, is this slide deck available to these people who at the class here? Are they able to get this?
Not from us.
So, and the last slide is my contact information, so you can reach out to me and I can happily pass you the slide deck, okay? So this is a reference of all the 11 Incoterms that are being used when the rules change in 2020. So this is a good reference guide. A lot of people will take the PowerPoint and just download this particular page and print it out and have it on their desk. So it's a good tool to have. So lastly in this, make sure you consider in every international transaction, we need to know what we're agreeing to. What point in time does that responsibility liability transfer? Make sure both parties are aware of their obligations. It changes every 10 years. And you have to make sure that internally in your organization that sales, customer service, finance, legal, all these different entities, logistics, has a comprehension of how Incoterms apply. Okay. So Export documentation. Remember that export documents are really import documents, okay? The documents pull the freight through the border. As we said, in the United States here, only, you know, 97% moves through without being inspected, and 95% around the world. So what pulls the goods through the border is the quality of that documentation. If the documentation isn't done right, that's a red flag, they stop it. Okay, so it becomes very critical. We have commercial invoices, bills of lading, packing lists, certificates of origin, quality control documents are the typical documents. The term prima facie is something used in international business. Prima facie means on face value. So if we create a commercial invoice and we say that on that commercial invoice, these goods are worth $15,000, Customs accepts that on the face value of that document, that that's what it's worth. If they find out that you created an invoice for $15,000 when in fact it's worth $150,000, and in an export transaction you're trying to help your buyer reduce their obligation for duties and taxes, that's a violation. Okay? And in our consulting practice, half of our business is proactively helping companies stay out of trouble. The other half is dealing with it once they're in there. And we get probably 4, 5, 6 cases a year from companies that exported a product overseas and changed the documentation to accommodate a buyer overseas and got caught. So a couple of references for you. Again, I'll send this slide deck to whoever wants it. Is our company has a tremendous amount of information on our website. We're part of an organization called the International Institute for World Trade. That's a great resource. Trade.gov is the Department of Commerce. They list every country in the world and tell you what the documentation requirements are for every country in the world that we trade with. Okay, so it's a great resource. Freight forwarders who are handling shipments on a daily basis also have a tremendous amount of information that's available to you. And also your customer. We think it's the best practice for a company in an export sale for your salesperson or customer service when the sale is made is to say to that customer, can you tell us what documentation you need to clear the goods through your border on your side? Who better to tell you than the party that's going to have that responsibility? Then we have the logistics, moving the goods from point A to point B. So we have shipping requirements. Appreciate the fact this has a huge impact on cost. Air freight, ocean freight. When you look at the difference in cost, when you look at it a per kilo or a per cubic meter basis, air freight is 18 times more expensive than ocean freight. Okay? So if we had a high value product that was susceptible to theft and pilferage and loss, we might definitely want to ship that by air. Again, the T words being high value, susceptibility to theft and damage, right? But most items are what we call normal valuations or lower valuations. Ocean freight is a much better option. When we come in and do an audit in a company, we have a red flag. We say to the company's financial team, give us a copy of your payables to all your carriers, okay? And from that, we'll determine how much do they have in ocean freight, how much they have in air freight. And if they have more than 10%, okay, in air freight, that's a red flag to us, okay, because it's that much more expensive. E-commerce requires it always to be shipped to a final destination, not any of those intermediate points, okay? So in an e-commerce transactions, which is growing very dramatically, not only here in the United States, but around the world, you have to know what those costs are when you have them going through the border, paying duties and taxes, the on-forwarding costs and so forth. You have to know all those expenses in that transaction in order to make sure you're covering it in your sale. Carriers become very important because there are carriers that focus on the import market, and there are carriers that focus on the export market. There are carriers that focus on U.S. to Europe and back and forth, U.S. to Latin America, U.S. to Asia and back and forth. So using a freight forwarder generally will help you discern which carriers will provide you the best advantage, the best scheduling, and give you the best assurance that your product's going to show up in a safe, usable condition. You have integrated carriers, UPS, FedEx, and DHL, and some specialized companies that do a lot of hand carry work and move certain specialty items like pharmaceuticals, as an example. Okay. But freight forwarders, at the end of the list here, is the biggest area of use by U.S. companies in their export sales, is to use a freight forwarder who has agents around the world or offices, and they help you facilitate the movement of the goods from your facility to wherever you've agreed to deliver it to overseas. Having a very good freight forwarder in your pocket is really a very important aspect of succeeding your business model. You have to be concerned with your client, and even though they may not be proactively asking you or talking to you, you need to be proactively talking to them, is what the documentation requirements are on that import. You need to understand what the import regulations are, specifically whether or not they need to get an import license or an import permit. In the United States here, when we import things, if you stay out of the pharmaceutical area, almost 99% of everything that comes to the United States comes in without an import license or an import permit. But if you went to a country like Japan, they require an import permit or license on anything that comes in, whether it's a bicycle, okay, or a pharmaceutical, food product, doesn't make a difference. They require a license, okay, as is most of European countries, Latin American countries, African countries, as well as Middle Eastern countries require import permits and import licenses. It's also a revenue area for their governments to get an additional fee when their companies decide to import. Packing, marketing, and labeling. The packing, marketing, and labeling that you're using here in your domestic sales may not work in your export sales. So you need to coordinate with your buyer, okay, or with whoever other professionals that you're using to make sure that you understand, you know, what is going to be required. And a lot of people, for example, shipping to the EU, says, well, I'm shipping to the EU, they're supposed to have common guidelines, but that's not necessarily true. They're supposed to, but in reality, we do a lot of pet products as an example. Pet products sold from the United States to Germany have one set of guidelines, sold into Spain have another whole set of guidelines. So you have to know by country where you're shipping to. And in some countries, it's regionalized, as it is here in the United States. If we import something into the United States, you'd think that federal regulations would control it, and in most cases it does. But you take a state like California, California has another whole set of regulations on how things are packed, marked, and labeled, and manufactured. So you have to also be sensitive to that when you export. You have to be concerned with product liability issues. Here in the United States, the importer of record is the manufacturer of record for product liability, and most countries around the world adapt that same concept, which was developed here when President Lincoln was in office, okay? And he made it a law, it was an executive order, and then eventually Congress passed a law that says if we import something, that importer becomes the manufacturer of record for product liability. So the person here in the United States doesn't have to go overseas to sue for any damages. They sue that importer here. And the same thing happens on most of our export sales. And lastly, is we need to make sure that we have a vetting process, we'll talk about that in a moment, of making sure we get paid. You can have a whole perfect transaction, done everything right, but if you don't get paid, it's for naught. So the quotes, the approach we suggest to the client is building the relationship. We think relationship trumps anything else that you can do. You can have a lawyer draw up the best contracts and so forth like that, but if you don't have a good working relationship, it's for naught, okay? Relationship becomes the critical factor in making things happen. Travel and invite. You've got to go see your customers overseas, and if you can't do that for whatever reason, then invite them here to see you. Okay? Learn their culture and a little bit about their language. They appreciate the fact that while English is the spoken language of international business, being able to say bonjour, okay, or gracias, you know, certain basic words is very important in the languages and cultures that you do business with. Be of local value, okay, meaning that if they're selling your products into their market, help them sell your products into their market. Being of value in their local market is what we mean here, because that makes you a more important supplier and vendor in that export transaction. And provide support in local business development, customer service, and warranty issues that you might have in that country or that market. Getting paid, the issue here really is understanding the risks involved. If I do a transaction and I'm based here in Chicago and I have a problem with a company in Texas or a company in Massachusetts or a company in New York, you know, we have rules on business that transacts between different states that protects me, okay? So I can feel reasonably comfortable that I have certain rights that are the same from one state to the next. But as soon as you sell overseas, those particular rights may not exist for a company that's, or a country overseas that you have, okay? So this becomes an important issue, knowing certain countries that you lose a lot of your collection rights, okay, as a foreign entity. So the big question is, if you were doing a risk assessment, is to say if the company didn't pay that I was selling to in Belgium or in Uganda, okay, what would I do to be able to collect that money? Okay, and that will help you determine on how you're going to get paid in that transaction. What support is out there? There actually are a lot of financial consulting companies. There are a lot of international banks that provide help and service in this regard. And the idea is that you're never going to eliminate 100% of the exposure, but you're trying to bring it down to an acceptable level. How am I doing on time? Oh, yeah, okay. So that's telling me how much is left? Okay. So there are financial products for exporters, okay? Getting paid up front, obviously, is the best of circumstances, but it's not competitive, okay? And an open account is generally what your customer's looking for, but you have to be careful in approaching that. Usually, you start out by getting paid up front and eventually leading to an open account in a successful, matured relationship. But I appreciate the fact that there are letters of credit, there are drafts, site, and time. There's collect shipments. This is another way of using freight forwarders, where whether they're making the delivery, they're collecting your money at the same time, okay? And then credit cards as well can be used for money transfers, okay? But always appreciate the fact that companies can turn credit card payments around, so you gotta be sensitive to that. Getting paid consideration is there has to be a due diligence and vetting process. Prior experience obviously is very critical. You have to look at, in your own company, what your risk tolerance is as to how much credit you're going to give to a company overseas, okay? And you try to maintain as much leverage as you possibly can. Particularly if it's a company, if you're selling something where they require warranty support or they require spare parts or a follow-up gives you some leverage in those types of circumstances. And again, relationship is important, and what really creates the best of relationships in any circumstance is trust. And establishing trust with your buyer is critical. Trade compliance aspect, appreciate the fact that there are over 28 government agencies that are involved in compliance management on export transactions. These are just some of the lead ones: Customs, the Department of State, Department of Commerce, Department of Justice, Federal Maritime Commission, Department of Treasury. And those of us who have specialty products, the FDA would get involved, or the USDA and so forth would be another resource. Okay, export trade compliance, one of the critical issues is the five questions. We have to know what we're selling. We have to know the quantity and the value. We have to know to what country it's going to, because there are some 30 countries around the world where we have restrictions, of which seven of them we can't sell anything to. Cuba would be an example of that now. North Korea, Sudan would be examples. And lastly is, what are they going to use it for? Okay, whatever they're buying. And we have to be able to answer those questions successfully in managing export compliance. Checking that denied parties, which we talked about earlier, making sure we get the documentation correctly. Recognize that the U.S. government says, we'll let you export this, but you're going to require an export license in order for you to be able to sell that product in the overseas market. So in summary here, you want to develop your skill sets in all these areas that we talked about. You want to pay attention learning the cultures. It goes a long way in building trust and the relationship with that party. You want to do due diligence in that vetting process of the people you sell to. And lastly, is you want to have resource development. All the websites that I gave to you on this slide deck are really great resources for you. So with that, my contact information is here, so if any of you want a copy of the slide deck, reach out to me, or if you have a question, please feel free to do that. So I'm right on the top.
Tom, thank you very much, Tom, and you for coming in the audience.
Any questions from you guys here?
Well, we started late.
We have a question.
So, okay.
Just do the one question.
Thank you. Earlier in the slide, you were discussing like the difference in the responsibility with XWorks, CIF, and FOB. I kind of missed some of it, of what you were saying, and who the responsibility lies on. So for like the XWorks, you were saying that the responsibility is from the manufacturer.
If you're looking at an export transaction, mm-hmm. the exporter has the least amount of responsibility on the left side of that chart. So okay. In an XWorks transaction, the exporter pushes the freight out onto their dock, and they're done.
Okay.
As compared to the DDP, which is the extreme one, delivered duty paid, in which you're taking responsibility to ship it all the way overseas, customs clear it, pay duties and taxes, and deliver it to their final
Okay, so
address.
They would pay the duties before it even gets to the destination.
You'd have to pay it whatever the rules are in their country, mm-hmm. how quickly you'd have to pay it. But it's usually within 5 and 7 days of the goods coming through the border.
Come through the border. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, so if you have more questions on this, you know, just reach out to me.
Thank you. I'd appreciate that.
Okay. Great.
Thank you all.